Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, mandate, booster shots, and the global vaccine supply. From the early days of the pandemic, public health officials pointed to COVID-19 vaccines as the silver bullet that could return our country to some sense of normalcy. The main question back then was whether scientists could create a safe and effective formula fast enough. Today, the U.S. faces a new set of questions. How to overcome vaccine hesitancy? What role should federal and state governments play in requiring vaccinations? Should we prioritize booster shots for Americans, or should we make sure those living in other countries get a first dose? Lawrence Gostin is an expert on global health law at Georgetown University. He joined me Friday afternoon to help explain the legal and health implications of those decisions. Professor Gostin, we've been masking, we've had social distancing, we've done lots of things to try to slow down or halt this virus, but it keeps roaring back, plus the Delta variant. Tell us what's happening in terms of numbers and why you think that is.
Well, you know, we've got, over 70% of our population at least partially vaccinated, but there's still a large swath of people who are not vaccinated. And so that is, as you said, Diane, we've really tried everything. We've distanced, we've masked, we've even locked down, and the virus does keep roaring back. And vaccinations are our way out. They are our way back to doing what we all yearn to do, which is, go out with a friend or family to a restaurant or a cafe, go to a concert, go to a movie, get on a plane and feel safe. We can't do any of these until we really boost the vaccination rate. So effectively now, we are in an epidemic, because it's the United States, of the unvaccinated. We have ample supply. It's free. We've made it accessible. We've used every health education tool that we possibly can. But there's still a large resistance, and we've politicized what is truly just a neutral scientific tool. It's not intended to punish or blame. It's only there to help us be healthy. And there's no reason that should be a political football, but it is.
And it's even more than that somehow. The resistance coming from some people seems so personal, seems as though I don't trust what the experts are saying. So it's even more than political.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of political opportunism, and that Republicans who want to get out of this pandemic as much as Democrats do, I've used it as kind of a political tool to try to, gain favor with their base. But you're right, there are a lot of good, decent, caring people who just don't trust. It's hard to know what to do because the evidence really couldn't be more clear. We've had 20 to 50,000 people in clinical trials shown it to be safe and effective. In the United States, we've given literally hundreds of millions of doses, highly safe and effective. Worldwide, we've given over 2 billion doses, safe and effective. It's hard to know what more we can do to encourage people to say, listen, it really is safe. And I think that they're getting pushed from below by social media and disinformation, and they're being pushed from above by opportunistic politicians that know better or should know better, but are fanning the flames. And it's a toxic brew, particularly here in the United States, where just about everything is political. Even putting on a mask is political. And so where do we go from here?
So that brings me to the question of mandates. And my question for you is about the history of vaccine mandates in this country. Where were the first vaccine mandates carried out and by whom?
You know, it might surprise you. The truth is that this is part of the American story, part of the American history. You know, a lot of politicians like Jim Jordan have said that it's un-American, the mandates. But in fact, they go back a long way. Even before Edward Jenner had discovered the idea of a vaccine in 1796, when he injected cowpox into somebody to prevent smallpox. And that's why we call it a vaccine, an inoculation, because it actually comes from the idea of a cow, because it was cowpox. But even before that, General George Washington, when he was fighting the Revolutionary War, ordered his troops to be inoculated with smallpox. This was before Jenner even discovered the idea of inoculation. It was basically taking the kind of rough, patchy skin of a smallpox victim and then scraping it onto the arm of a soldier. And so all soldiers did that. Now, there was a reason for vaccine hesitancy then, but not now. And so it went back then. And I have to say that within a few years after 1796, when Edward Jenner did this, in 1809, there was the very first vaccine mandate in the United States for smallpox. And ever since then, we've been mandating vaccines, initially for smallpox. The Supreme Court has upheld compulsory vaccination not once, but twice. And right now, and for the last half a century, every child who goes to school is required in every state of the union to get a series of CDC-recommended childhood vaccinations. So this is not foreign to America. It's very American.
So, first of all, I have to ask you, did George Washington's approach succeed?
Yes and no. Though obviously, there were people who contracted smallpox from the wild, from the battlefield. Many contracted it actually from the inoculation itself. But often it was just a very mild illness, and then they became immune to smallpox. So it was part of the Continental Army's strategy to live. And it's not very well known to Americans, but actually more people die of infectious diseases and infections during war, including World War I and World War II, than die of bullets. So that's why we routinely have, for a long, long time, required vaccinations in our military.
So the question that people are raising now is, does the President of the United States have the authority to mandate a countrywide vaccine? What is your opinion?
It's not even an opinion. I'm quite sure of it. He does not. He does not have the power to compel the entire nation to be vaccinated. The president has never had that power. That's a wide-held myth that he does have that power. The two Supreme Court cases that I referred to both were empowering cities and states to require vaccines, and they can require vaccines of every resident in their state. But the federal government is a government of limited powers, and so President Biden can only use those limited powers, and he has, and I think quite effectively. He's used the Occupational Health and Safety Act to require vaccination in large businesses. He's used his power of the purse to require vaccines for healthcare settings, and especially for those who get Medicare and Medicaid funding. And he's ordered the entire federal workforce to be vaccinated. And he can do that because he's the head of the federal workforce, the way that any business can require their vaccinations. So absolutely, President Biden is within his powers. He's done it effectively. In my view, he's on rock solid legal ground, but he does not have the power to extend a vaccine mandate to the general population.
What about nursing homes?
Nursing homes are extraordinarily important, Diane, because as you and all your listeners know, they have been hotspots for the amplification and super spreader events that we've seen throughout the pandemic, right from the very beginning, along with cruise ships and religious services and things like that, where we've seen lots of major outbreaks. Yes, the president does have certain powers because the federal government both funds residential care homes through Medicaid and Medicare, and also regulates them. So using one or both of those powers would give the president authority to do it. So, I mean, it's true that a hospital or a residential care home could say, no, I don't want to require a vaccine, but then they can't get Medicare and Medicaid funding. And I think that that's, you know, a choice that they would have to make. As long as President Biden weren't being coercive, that is taking away every piece of Medicare funding or Medicaid funding, but used it in a targeted, limited way, he would be on solid legal ground.
So what about governors? What about mayors? Who is it who can control what happens in each state?
Any state can require vaccinations. Normally, it requires a law, a state law that's signed by the governor, who can then require vaccinations. The governor, on his or her own discretion, even without a law, can require vaccines of the entire, of all public officials working for the state. Cities could do the same thing. And also, often depends upon the city, but some cities have, you know, quite extensive home rule, like New York City. New York City could undoubtedly require vaccinations, even if the state government didn't authorize the vaccine.
Now, what about mask mandates? Same thing, even for young children in schools? Is that up to the school principal? Is that up to the mayor? Or is that up to the governor?
Well, you know, it depends upon the state and the circumstance. Normally, what you will see is that school boards have authority to set safety conditions in their schools. And that most of them do. A lot of them have done that and required masks. A state can also require a mandate, or a city could require a mandate. New York is masked in school. California has masked in school. My own state in Maryland has done the same thing in Washington, D.C. So, yes, there's wide discretion from its state government and city government to require everyone to wear masks. It's got to be evidence-based, but masks have a strong evidence base behind them. And the CDC does not recommend that children under 2 have to mask. But everyone else should mask. I know at Georgetown University, where I work, we have a vaccine mandate and an indoor mandate. No exceptions to the rule. Our vaccination coverage is 99%, and everybody masks up.
But what does that mean for the 1% who are not vaccinated? Are they allowed on campus? Are they allowed in classrooms? What happens there?
Well, they have to have a valid medical or religious justification, And if they do, then they have to be subjected to twice weekly testing. You know, other universities have taken similar kinds of steps.
Yes.
I'm using Georgetown because I've been advising the deans and the president about it. And the Public Health Advisory Group, which I'm a member of, has recommended this layered approach. The layered approach basically is compulsory vaccination, compulsory masking, and ventilation. Those, and then testing. Those four components can keep any community quite safe, and I'm confident that it will keep us safe.
A quick break. When we come back, the rest of my conversation with Lawrence Gostin.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back. Here's the rest of my conversation with Lawrence Gostin, professor of global health law at Georgetown University and author of the new book, Global Health Security. Now, what about the rules for businesses with more than 100 employees? How is that being enforced?
Well, this is, first, let me explain why I think President Biden had the power to do that, and then I'll tell you a little bit about the enforcement. A lot of people have said, particularly governors and senators, that this is an unconstitutional overreach. Well, the truth is exactly the opposite. In fact, in my view, President Biden is at the very height of his presidential powers because he's not acting unilaterally or capriciously. He's acting with the full and explicit authority of Congress. Congress passed the Occupational Safety and Health Act in 1970 precisely because there was a weak patchwork of state worker safety regulation, and it wanted to set a national uniform standard. He's using that law to require vaccinations, and I applaud him for doing that. Most employers want to do it anyway. We're already doing it anyway. But it gives political cover to those that, you know, really want to keep their workers safe. They want to keep their workers productive. They want to keep their customers safe and coming into the store. And so mandating a vaccine makes perfect sense. So Biden has that power. He's now directed the Department of Labor to set an emergency standard about what the details will be. That should happen fairly soon. And then OSHA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, it's its job to enforce. And it can enforce in many ways. First of all, for most OSHA standards, employers comply even before the standard goes into effect. And businesses are already doing that with vaccines. Secondly, it gives any worker the right to complain to OSHA that the vaccine mandate hasn't gone into effect. OSHA can also do spot inspections, and there are hefty fines. So it has really good ways to implement and enforce its rules, even though OSHA has been poorly staffed and needs to be staffed more.
And what about those businesses or even restaurants with smaller than or fewer than 100 employees? What happens there?
They are not part of Biden's mandate requirement, but they have every legal power and I think an ethical obligation to require vaccines in their workplace, no matter how small. This is particularly true in places like, as you say, restaurants or childcare or other areas where people just don't feel comfortable, you know, going out or sending their kids or socializing in a large group of people who are, they don't know the vaccine status of them. I'd also like to see restaurants, to be quite frankly, have a proof of vaccination system. So just a customer that comes in just shows a digital on their iPhone or their smartphone, a barcode saying, yeah, I've been vaccinated. I know many of us, including me, possibly you, Diane, are a little bit reluctant to go into a restaurant indoors because even though we've been vaccinated, you know, we're cautious, rightly so. And I think if we were assured that everyone around us was vaccinated, that would boost confidence. It would boost the economy. People would be going out to eat more, back to movies, back to concerts and theater. And it would be a joy for everyone, but it would be good for business.
And you're sort of talking about a vaccine passport.
Yes.
That many people are pushing back against. I gather you'd be in favor.
I would. Well, New York City already has one. It's called the Key to New York. Paris has one and other parts of France. And when Emmanuel Macron put what he calls the passe sanitaire into effect, you might recall that there were protests in the streets. But what you might not know is that within a few days after he made the announcement of the passe sanitaire, there were 3 to 4 million additional French people getting vaccinated. And the same thing happened with Houston Methodist Hospital, the first hospital that mandated it in their hospital. Basically, there was a big pushback. Everybody said, oh, well, we'll quit. But now they have over a 99% vaccination rate.
Couple of things. What about these medical or religious exemptions? How clear are the standards?
They're about as clear as mud. So, you know, if a state wants to mandate a vaccine, it's commonly thought that it has to give a religious exemption. It does not. Most states do, but there are a handful of states that don't. New York, California, and even deep red states like Mississippi and West Virginia don't have any religious exemptions, and the courts have upheld that. The Equal Employment Opportunity Commission and the Department of Justice suggests that businesses should offer religious exemptions. We do at Georgetown, but our experience is that most of them are bogus. If you actually trace back, a lot of them come from the same mega church, which might be 1,000 miles away from Washington. Or there are people who have tried to get medical exemptions from some doctor somewhere in California or elsewhere. We turn it down, and then they ask for a religious one. So I know of no organized religion that's against vaccines, and quite the opposite. Most religions have a core tenet, if not all religions, have a core value of life, and vaccines save lives. It's inconceivable to me that a religious value would be against vaccines. And in fact, the Pope has been vaccinated and has highly recommended it to his followers.
What about medical exemptions?
Medical exemptions are required and they're absolutely justified. But again, people don't realize that they're vanishingly rare. A lot of people think that you get a medical exemption if you say you're immunocompromised. But the truth is that vaccines are safe for most people who are immunocompromised. It's just that they don't mount as great immune response. That's why we've already rolled out boosters for the immunocompromised. But the only time that really can get a medical exemption is if you've had a vaccine and you had a bad reaction to it, you're allergic to it, and had a bad allergic attack. That's very, very rare. But when it does happen, We have to respect that and obviously not harm the person by giving them the vaccine, but that's astonishingly rare.
I want to go back to a word you used. You mentioned boosters, and they are recommended so far for people 60 and over. I gather both the FDA and the CDC are today coming out with a decision on whether to actually recommend it, even though after President Biden talked about that third shot in the case of Pfizer or Moderna, but currently only Pfizer, many people got that third shot because they were made available by CVS, by other pharmacies. What is your feeling about that controversy on a third shot for vulnerable Americans or distribution of that medication abroad?
Yeah, the White House got way out ahead of its public health agencies when it announced boosters. The truth is that neither CDC nor FDA have recommended or authorized boosters yet, except for the immunocompromised. The FDA Advisory Committee is meeting today, and the CDC Advisory Committee will meet thereafter. But even before all of that happened, nearly 2 million people have voted with their feet and they've got the third shot. It's surprising to me that pharmacies have actually done this. Technically, they shouldn't really be doing it. It hasn't been authorized to give a third shot yet for the general population.
They were all depending on that research coming out of Israel.
They were, but that's not for them to decide. That's for public health agencies to decide.
I understand.
And CDC and FDA have yet to do it. You know, we'll have to see what CDC and FDA do. My guess is that the Biden rollout for the general population may very well ultimately get approved and recommended, but it'll be a rocky road. I don't think that all of the advisory committee are going to be in lockstep behind the president on this. But I think eventually it will happen. You know, there's been a huge controversy about this. You know, first of all, the data show that the vaccines hold up rather robustly against in preventing serious disease, hospitalization, and deaths. But there is a certain waning of immunity. But at the same time, we are faced with a world where we have virtually no vaccines, where health workers are going to work every day unvaccinated because they can't get a dose. And so in a way, to boost our entire population is a little tone deaf and a slap in the face to the World Health Organization that recommended a moratorium on any boosters. My view is the middle road. I think that the United States should authorize boosters only for the most at risk. That is for health and residential care workers, for the elderly, and for people with serious chronic conditions. And then wait until more data arrive for the rest of the population and more of the rest of the world gets a chance to be vaccinated. That's in our own best interests because as long as there's unchecked SARS-CoV-2 and the Delta variant particularly circulating globally, we're likely to see new variants that will maybe even escape vaccine effectiveness, and then they will travel to the United States. So it's morally right, and it's in our best interests, but there is a middle way. And I'm surprised that we're stuck in two different camps. You know, one says just boost everybody, and the other says boost nobody. I think there's a way for us to kind of have our cake and eat it too, so to speak.
Professor Gostin, before we close, is there anything else you'd like to add?
I would just say this, Diane. You know, I know that a lot of people who haven't been vaccinated, they're good, decent people. I think that particularly the progressive left has been too quick to blame, to shame, and to want to punish. I'm not in that camp. I think we need to have sympathy and compassion. But I do say this. There's such good reasons to roll up your sleeve and get the jab. Do it for yourself. Do it for your family and your neighbors. Do it for the health workers when you go into hospital. And do it for the common good. It's the ethically right thing to do, but it's also really in your best interests and everybody's best interests to do it.
Professor Gosden, thank you so much.
Thank you, Diane. I'm a great admirer of yours, as you know, and I was really pleased to be with you.
That was Lawrence Gosden, professor of global health law at Georgetown University and author of the new book, Global Health Security. And that's all for today. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Bruntberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Allison Brody with help from Sandra Baker. Our engineer today is Michael Kidd. Thanks for listening, all. Be well. Stay safe. I'm Diane Rehm.